It's lunchtime, so to the food programme naturally, and Sheila Dillon tells the story of how one woman over four decades influenced millions with her ideas and her cooking.
Chez Panisse, menu. Wednesday, June 1st, 1988. Local salmon with fennel, lemon, and parsley vinaigrette. Linguine with Chino ranch.
And I just had a mission to find the ingredients. And in the finding of the ingredients, I was educating myself as well as everyone else who worked with me.
Garden salad, vanilla souffle with warm fruit.
When I think of Alice Waters, I think of a visionary, an educator, and a political activist, somebody who wanted to change the world.
Restaurants and their owners don't often change the world, but in Berkeley, California, there's one restaurateur with a place on a not very glamorous street who can make that wild claim. Not that Alice Waters, founder of Chez Panisse, would be so bold, but many others all over the world will tell you she's responsible for creating a real alternative to North America's fast food culture. In August 1971, when she opened her restaurant, she was a utopian, a romantic, who believed she could somehow recreate all that she'd learned to love in France. She did that and so much more, and it's that story we're telling in this program. Four decades after Chez Panisse opened, I met Alice Waters to find out how exactly a restaurant pioneer turned into a food guru, influencing some of the most powerful politicians in the world. It's a story about counterculture, and it all starts in 1960s California at Berkeley, where a 19-year-old Alice arrived to study. She'd grown up in suburban New Jersey, where her father worked in life insurance, worlds apart from the university campus at the epicenter of something very big.
I ask you to consider, if this is affirmed, and if the Board of Regents...
Berkeley in the early part of the 60s must have been a terrific place to be. It was the beginning of the modern mass student movement, but much more than that, it was the beginning of the radical politics of the 1960s.
Jeff Andrews is a lecturer in politics at the Open University.
Students at that time wanted free speech, they wanted political activities, they didn't want their elders telling them what to do, they didn't want the university teachers telling them what they should be reading. But it was a much broader cultural movement as well. They had different kinds of music, they wanted to live in different ways. To be around at that time listening to those speeches, people who wanted to change the world, to create a different way of living and believing they could do it and not being restrained by their peers, by their parents, by the bosses. That must have been an extraordinary time.
Mario Savio, who was the leader of the free speech movement, his family was Sicilian. And he was somebody who drank a glass of wine with dinner. And when he talked about the change that we were going to make and the way we needed to live our lives, I know he must have had this big picture of coming around the table at some point.
There's a time when the operation of the machine becomes so odious, makes you so sick at heart, that you can't take part. You can't even passively take part. And you've got to put your bodies upon the gears and upon the wheels.
It's very significant that Mario Savio was Sicilian, because obviously food is central to the lives of all Sicilians, and the idea of eating together in a communal space was really important.
I certainly responded to his messages. He seemed so incredibly articulate and dignified, and so I know he planted a seed in me.
A seed that was nurtured in France.
I learned to eat, really, in France. I went as a student, and I feel like I had never eaten before. And I ate things that woke me up. The marketplaces were in every little corner of Paris, and people went and bought their hot baguettes every morning. They went to the market twice a day. They came home and had lunch with their family, the kids did, spent 2 hours. Students went to all kinds of cultural events for free. I really felt like I wanted to live that kind of life. It really inspired me, and so that's what I was trying to do. And I think I was really imprinted by that experience of being in France. I didn't know it at the time that I was bringing back more than the food. But I was really bringing back a set of values that directed and really shaped the restaurant and the way that we would work in the restaurant, the way that we would share responsibility, the way we were non-compromising. I think a lot of people who were opening restaurants at that time were just doing it, you know, from the seat of their pants. I mean, you know, just stirring it up each night and hoping people liked it, but without any real training. And I didn't have any real training, and most of the people who worked at the restaurant did not have that. But they were all very interested in the history of food.
And so, while all around her in California, countercultural cafes majored in badly cooked lentils, lumpen brown bread, and sprouted seeds with everything, she opened Chez Panisse, named after a character in a series of films by the French director Marcel Pagnol.
I wanted the restaurant for my friends so that we could all eat there, and I didn't have to cook at home, and they could pay. And I was thinking in this very practical way of doing something that I loved and being paid to do it. That was really when fast food culture was upon us. And Chez Panisse was so different in a way. I mean, it just was a single menu. I didn't want to have food left over that I might have to serve the next day or throw out. So I thought, this is how I cook at home, and I'm just going to give everybody the same food, and they'll make a reservation, and I'll know how many people are coming, and that's what we'll do. And so it had some bumps at the beginning, certainly, of things that didn't turn out, and people complaining. But on the whole, they were a little charmed by that, the fixed price menu, and no choices.
It's poor cooking. I mean, there are no luxury foods in Provençal cuisine. A bouillabaisse originally was an old fisherman's stew made out of the leftover fish that he couldn't sell.
Richard Olney was ready-made to be a great influence on Alice, a native of Iowa who'd found in France and French food the way to live as a painter and food writer.
Bouillabaisse is made out of doors. They build a fire of olive wood and old grapevine stumps. And she prepares a fish soup inside for the bouillon. And then all of the fish are put to marinate with saffron and olive oil and the garlic smashed up and so forth. And
we looked at the books of Elizabeth David, and we read them cover to cover, and we knew Richard Olney, and we studied him. I knew Mater Joffrey because she was giving cooking classes in Berkeley at the time. I met Diana Kennedy as well.
Mexican cooking,
exactly. But these are people that were very serious about their study of food and where it came from. And that helped us, too, to choose the tried and true. I almost never wanted to go out of the sort of leg of lamb with beans. That was just it. You had to have beans with lamb. And you couldn't have it with mashed potatoes. You couldn't have it with... It was the classic French dish, and I wanted to do it that way.
Sure. Always remember to taste things, because you can spend quite a bit of time and then forget to taste and find that it isn't just right.
Now, Julia Child had been on television, and she was such a francophile, and she opened the doors and made a path
for me. You think that was important?
Oh, very, very important for me. I think we followed in that path.
Sunday, October 31st, 1971. Hors d'oeuvres variés, including homemade terrine.
I used to write the menus in French.
Bœuf en dos Provençal, salade, $4.50.
All the way through the first years of the restaurant. I mean, they were always in French until the food became so about California that I was making it up to put it in French, and we started writing them in English.
And so there were wider shifts going on in Alice's world.
I wasn't thinking at the beginning about where that food came from. I wanted the taste. But the great thing about it was, is in searching for the taste, I found the organic local farmers and ranchers and fishermen. And then I became dependent upon them for the goodness of the food that we served. And I wanted their names on the menus. And it happened really like that, very almost naively.
Finding local growers and producers now became part of the work of Chez Panisse. The chefs took turns in working as the restaurant's forager, not delving in hedgerows, but travelling around California looking for exceptional producers. By the time the food program visited Chez Panisse in 1995, that foraging had helped create a web of farmers' markets, community-supported farms, and small producers turning out some of the best-tasting food in North America. As presenter Simon Parks found out, some of the very, very best was grown for Chez Panisse by Bob Canard.
If you go out there and you observe nature and learn from all of the clues that nature leaves behind, because the plant doesn't lie, the plant doesn't cheat, the plant doesn't wear makeup, the plant doesn't wear dark glasses, it's naked right there before you, it doesn't run away, and all you have to do is pay attention to it, and it'll tell you whether it's happy or not. And I'm going to pick up this leek, and I'm going to thunk this leek on the wooden table here before us, and this is a solid leek. And I can smash it because I'm much bigger and stronger. But this guy has some integrity to it. It has high impact strength. It's got solidity to it.
It also has the most wonderful smell. I mean, if you just sniff.
Yeah, it is a good smell.
I mean, you get a leek smell, which is what you don't normally get.
Well, that's what the leek's about, is its fragrance and its nutritional support. And it's all of its vitality comes through its smell.
I was absolutely passionate about pleasing people. So I would go out in the dining room to see who was eating what, and I wanted to know why they weren't eating their food if they didn't eat it. And I changed the menu all the time to see whether it would work. And so I was determined in that way to win people over. I wasn't trying in any way to push them away, to act as if you don't eat it, then don't bother coming back. It was like, if you don't like this, what else can I bring you? I'm sure you'll like this. Do you want a smaller portion or bigger portion? You know, that kind of, I had strong ideas of what I liked that I wanted to introduce people to. But I wasn't going to force them. I wanted them to fall in love with it. I wanted them to learn about this. As I was learning, we were all learning together.
Monday, August 4th, 1997. Summer vegetable salads, tomato, cucumber, eggplant, and green bean. Sonoma duck breast grilled over fig wood with roasted figs.
The restaurant was a success. It was regularly listed as one of the best in North America. But suddenly, that alone, even as the engine of a revolution in local food production, wasn't enough.
Well, I always, from the very beginning, wanted to change the world. I wanted to live in this other place. And so I realized that didn't exist in Berkeley, and so I had to make it myself. You know, after so many years in the restaurant business, maybe around the 15th or 20th year, I realized, you know, we just couldn't keep this little idealistic restaurant happening with what was going on in the bigger picture. I mean, what comes upstream is coming downstream. And I was really awakened most particularly when I had a child. And then I thought back, oh my goodness, the public school system. That's the place that can reach every child in America.
That involvement led to the Edible Schoolyard. In 2001, food program reporter Gerard Baker went to see where it all began.
Well, the sun's just poking through the clouds on a warm autumnal day here in Berkeley. This is Martin Luther King Jr. School, and this is the Edible Schoolyard. There's a squirrel just staring at me as if I'm mad, talking into my microphone.
Hi, I'm Brandy.
Hi, I'm Emily.
Here you have flowers, you have food,
your vegetables.
Yeah, your vegetables, and all this other beautiful stuff is really peaceful, and it's really kind of weird, actually, because in the middle of a loud school,
it's a nice, peaceful,
quiet place that you can come. And you can, like, learn how to do different stuff here. Just, like, if you don't have a garden at home, this is, like, the backyard for everyone.
It's like your home.
This is the background for everyone. This is the backyard for everyone. You can come here. You can eat.
You can relax. And me and her came here all the time. We just come here and chill. And we just hang out and help Kelsey and everybody with the gardening.
And they have really good raspberries going.
But the ideas for the Edible Schoolyard and the Edible Schoolyard Academy that grow out of it, taking its philosophy into all 50 states and 33 other countries, came not just from Chez Panisse. Catherine Sneed was a therapist at the San Francisco County Jail who'd worked with prisoners to create a garden so successful that some inmates were reluctant to leave when their sentences ended. She then developed another garden attached to a halfway house where ex-prisoners could grow food to sell locally.
I had gotten in some trouble in 1996, and I heard about this program through my friend. And so I came down to check it out, and she hired me right on the spot, and I've been working here ever since. And I haven't been in trouble ever since. Yeah. Everything I know, I learned here. Pretty good at it now, too, though. So I supervise the newcomers, show them, you know, how to pick the vegetables and how to weed them and everything, you know. So I show them the ropes.
How does it change people? How do you see the change in people as they...
Well, I think it changes people in a positive, because they self-esteem lifts. Where you can go to work and get a paycheck instead of hanging out on the corner doing nothing or selling drugs and going back and forth to jail. This keep you out of jail, keep you positive.
I was just released from custody this past Friday, and I started employment here that following Monday. So it is encouragement to reassure me that there is something out there to do after, you know, being released from being here incarcerated, and it's helpful. It gives you a lot of guidance.
Catherine Sneed had a profound impact on Alice's thinking.
She explained to me that the really transformational part was not only the growing of it, the empowerment of growing, but in the offering of it to the homeless centers in San Francisco. So I thought, well, maybe this could work in a school with teenagers. Maybe this could actually be a transformational experience. And in fact, we have discovered that it is. When they grow it and cook it, they all eat it. It's become something desirable. And I think, in fact, that it really is a way to awaken just about everybody.
An awakening idea that spread as far as Pennsylvania Avenue.
Armed with a pitchfork and a shovel, First Lady Michelle Obama digs into her next project, an 1,100-square-foot vegetable garden on the south lawn of the White House.
It was extraordinary that she chose to plant the garden as her first very big public project after the election. And she called it her organic garden.
I want to make sure that our family, as well as the staff and all the people who come to the White House and eat our food, get access to really fresh vegetables and fruits.
But has the Obama administration followed through on this early enthusiasm for, as Alice would put it, edible education?
I'm sort of looking and hoping for a renewed passion about it. And a really strong voice from the president. We need that. We need that in the way that we needed physical education in this country when Kennedy was president.
I want to urge that this be a matter of great priority. A sound mind in a sound body is one of the oldest slogans of the Western world.
But he became a champion for physical fitness. And every school in America incorporated physical education into the core curriculum of the school. And they built gyms and they put in tracks and they graded children on their performance. I think that we need edible education into the public school system in a much more dramatic way.
But are you going to get that? I mean, it looks from over here as though she's been pushed into saying, you know, let's move, and the focus has shifted from food and from growing and cooking.
I think it probably has, but I do believe in her heart of hearts that she really cares. She cares deeply about children, and she cares deeply about nourishment.
And these are issues that I care deeply about, especially when they affect America's children. Obesity, diabetes, heart disease, high blood pressure are all diet-related health issues that cost this country more than...
We are just learning at this very late date that the food we eat might actually be making us sick. The idea of health and food has not been put together, even though this is something that's been at the core of civilization since its beginning. And yet we're just thinking about that now. And of course, fast food culture has given us complete amnesia about what might be good for us and what is seasonally ripe and all of that. And so we have to learn again as a nation how to eat. And we're all going to have to learn together, really. And the best way, of course, is to begin with small children at school.
Jeff Andrews again.
I think the food movement, a bit like the environmental movement and the feminist movement, have moved from the last 30 or 40 years from the margins to the mainstream. So we can see through the feminist movement major gains, position of women and rights and so on. And the same with the environmental movement. I mean, not all the objectives have clearly been achieved, but a similar case is there with the food movement. And I think what started as a counterculture around food, and Alice Waters' Shape and East restaurant was obviously born in Berkeley in San Francisco at the heart of this movement, continues. And many of the activities she's continued with, obviously her restaurant has been a success, but her educational activities remains rooted in that kind of politics, an awareness of challenging power, of providing an alternative food culture to the dominant one.
I have been involved in the very good news, always. I'm involved with the children of the people who work at Japanese, who have now come back and who are now waiting on tables there. I'm seeing the people who have come to eat there and their children starting restaurants and businesses all around the country, around the world. It's amazing. It's almost like in the underground. These things that are popping up, how articulate young people are that know what's good for them and what's not, who just want to become farmers. It's amazing. So I'm hopeful. And I'm not interested in sort of overthrowing the government in this delicious revolution. I am interested in winning people over.
Alice Waters ending this week's edition of the Food Programme. The presenter was Sheila Dillon. The programme was produced in Bristol by Rich Ward and Dan Saladino.